Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Who's coming in with us this evening is Tony Gosling from all places, New Zealand. Welcome to our program, Tony Gosling.
Thanks very much for having me on, George, and I'm talking to you from a place called Queenstown, which is in the South Island of New Zealand. It's a really beautiful place, and there's quite a lot of American tourists here. Actually, most of the tourists seem to be either Koreans or Chinese.
Really?
But it is actually a beautiful place.
You're surrounded by Orientals, right?
Well, a little bit. I mean, I wouldn't say totally surrounded, but there's loads going on here. We've had a really busy weekend in Queenstown with just about everything coming together at once. We had the St. Patrick's Day on Friday, plus we've had the Harley Davidson convention, plus a local food and wine festival going on all weekend, so it's been really busy here. Almost impossible to get anywhere to stay for the night apart from pitching a tent on the side of the lake. The weather's been absolutely fantastic, and really enjoying my stay and my holiday. But obviously, you know, just the fact that I'm having a holiday in New Zealand doesn't mean I've not been keeping track of what's been going on around the world.
Boy, I tell you what, how much longer are you going to be down there? Another couple of weeks or what?
That's right, about another fortnight, spending a month over here. There's no point in coming to the opposite side of the world and only spending a week there. So, spending pretty much the whole of March here, then stopping in Singapore on the way home.
Okay, what do you think? Merkel was just here in Washington, D.C., Chancellor Merkel, and he was cool to her, President Trump was. He wasn't very friendly. Yeah.
Okay, so there are disputes, aren't there?
Boy.
Basically, I mean, the other thing is, I don't know whether this is genuine or not, but you've had this big dispute between Volkswagen and the US government, which I think is really just a kind of quid pro quo for the Germans not going along with US policy as regards to Russia and Syria. And when people don't do what they're told by the Israel and the United States and the UK, there's usually some price to pay, and I think that's what it's been.
Right.
That's why there's this frostiness there.
Yeah. He welcomed her, you know, with a handshake. But then later on, the reporters were trying to get them to shake hands in the White House and stuff, but he's a little cool to her, you know. But she made a point at the press.
Well, I think you've got to be a little bit careful here because there is an attempt to, play up these differences.
Sure.
The other thing is when you're a world leader, and the press pack starts to tell you do this, do that for the cameras, like, you know, you're at some kind of seaside holiday resort posing for the local photographer guy who's going to charge you the earth for your photographs in 10 minutes time. But you know, that some of these world leaders don't necessarily just want to be maneuvered around and told exactly what they can do, especially when there's already been a photo opportunity with them just before, with them shaking hands. Do they want to really go through all that again? So I think we've got to be a bit careful about, jumping to conclusions about real relations.
Right.
Because, of course, it's like a Russian doll, ironically. You know, you've got what's really going on, and then you've got what the public are being told is very far away from that. I think we're living in an age today like Goebbels at Nazi Germany, where most of what we're getting is got half-truths poisoned with lies. I mean, most of what we're getting is basically true, but there are some enormous lies involved in that day after day after day. I mean, for example, this whole business of ISIS, you know, being some kind of enemy. Well, it's an enemy that people who are very close to our own governments, often funded by our taxpayer dollars and pounds, that are funding ISIS, you know, so, and controlling ISIS. So we're being led a merry dance that somehow ISIS is the enemy, when actually we're paying for that enemy to create an enemy. If you remember all that time ago, gosh, I think it was John Stockwell. I don't know if you remember him.
Oh, yes.
The CIA officer, one of the highest ranking officers ever to blow the whistle. And then he did his brilliant book called In Search of Enemies, about the CIA going around the world looking for people to pick fights with. Basically, that's what the British did as part of the British Empire, and it's the Americans that have taken on that mantle ever since the Second World War. Really, the US has been trying to do the same sort of thing, but not in quite as subtle a way as the Brits used to do it, quite subtly in many ways, particularly with the propaganda. Obviously New Zealand here, there is actually quite good relations between the natives, the Maori and the, well, become the settlers. In fact, the Maoris here, one of the things I was finding out, George, is fascinating as you get chit-chatting with these old-timers, old-timer New Zealanders, down the pub and whatever, and in the bars, is that the Maoris have done amazing legal battles. And they've successfully won a lot of compensation now for the land that was stolen from them in many parts of New Zealand. And with that money, they have not been idle, a bit like some of the North American Indians have made an absolute fortune from their investments. Here, some of the biggest tourist attractions are actually Maori-owned. And so even though the people who are operating these Maori companies, foundations and trusts and things, are often, you know, white New Zealanders and people maybe been trained in London, New York, etc., chief executives, financial officers, etc., the Maoris are actually the ones controlling the trusts and the charities that are making fantastic amounts of money out of the various tourist traps there are around here. So they've done a very good job, I think, in getting back at the settlers, getting, you know, back at the colonialists, and actually saying, well, look, we're going to be on a par with you financially, and yes, we'll share this land with you, but don't think that we're going to be some kind of underclass.
Right. The row about this wiretapping is continuing on. I interviewed Duncan Campbell yesterday, and he knows a lot about the GCHQ there in UK. And, you know, they came up with, a number of years ago at that Menwith station there, they came up with the idea of, why don't we just record everything? See what I mean? And that's basically what they've been doing. You know, they just record everything.
Well,
now,
it's,
you know,
true, but look,
yeah,
really what they want is, okay, let me just explain what I think they're doing with this. I mean, think, for example, with this call we're making now, this broadcast we're recording now.
Right.
Everything now is listened to in real time. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to add to everything, to the stream of things which are being listened to in real time. So they started off, I guess, with phone calls, listening to specifically targeted telephones.
Right.
Due to the digital exchanges, they became possible through the massive increases in bandwidth and computing power, memory and storage, that kind of thing. It became possible to listen to all phone calls so that you could, if you wanted to, go back through somebody's phone call history, you know, maybe even 4 or 5 years, listen to old phone calls that they'd made a long time ago. So they did that. And then what they've been doing ever since is to try and add and add and add to that ability to record people's lives, effectively. And this is ordinary people. This is not people who are terrorists. And what the way they justify it to themselves, people like NSA and GCHQ, is that, oh, well, at some point, this information might be useful to us. So, but of course, what it does enable them to do is to target specific journalists, MPs, young, up-and-coming political activists, so that they can kind of squash political activism before it's even started. A little bit like in the Second World War, one of the big plans was to bomb the shipyards where the Nazis were building U-boats. And what the British planned to do was to bomb those places, where even where the U-boats were being designed, so that they couldn't even get to the building them stage. And that's what they're doing, I think, with the public now, is that they're trying to disrupt political activism at very early levels, listening to all political activists, people that might be trying to change things for the better in the future, and targeting them with this mass surveillance. For example, with Google, every time you type into there,
right,
something,
right,
the NSA is reading that in real time. So if you type in something like NSA, immediately they're going to be interested in, like, what's this person looking for in the NSA. But it'll also be key specific individuals, so people who are very powerful behind the scenes, in the banking fraternities, in places like Goldman Sachs. If there are journalists who are looking up those individuals on Google, the NSA, Google will be feeding that information through in real time. So they'll say, right, this guy, 2 minutes ago, he Googled this, he's now looking at that, looks like he's putting an article together X, Y, and Z, and they can start to actually have an operational arm to go in to disrupt that individual before they've even written the article, George. This is how crazy this is getting now.
I think you're right.
On top of all that.
Yeah, you're right about that, Tony.
On top of all that.
Yeah.
We've got the revelations through the Vault 7 hacking is making it absolutely clear things that we suspected anyway. I mean, we did back the same year that he died a whole program about Michael Hastings and the way that he, it appeared, was killed. His car was hacked. There was a lot of evidence that it had been. I mean, he'd told his girlfriend, "My car is acting suspiciously," that same evening he died. There's also the film from the police camera of his car shooting past at 70 or 80 miles an hour, running a red light, and you can see that his brake lights are on. So he's got his foot jammed on the brake, but the car is still speeding along at 70, 80 miles an hour. And he, of course, was investigating John Brennan and looking at the CIA spying on congressmen, on senators in the United States, trying to disrupt certain things which might be coming down the pipeline, which the CIA didn't like, through the political arm, the elected part of government, and also, of course, it does look as if, with the cooperation of Mercedes, because they would have needed that, that Brennan and Mercedes decided together, look, this guy, I'm probably going to take him out. And Mercedes, well, it was very interesting the way, because he was driving a Mercedes just like Princess Diana, and also just like the chauffeur for Vladimir Putin, by the way, whose Mercedes veered across inexplicably right into the path of his car. So I think Mercedes really is a car that nobody should buy. And anyone that's got a modern Mercedes, anything built after about 2005 maybe, or maybe even around about 2000, should just get rid of their car. Because these things are dangerous. You know, obviously you can't stop someone hitting you head on coming in the opposite direction. But you don't want to be in a car that starts doing things, you know, which you don't want it to be. But anyway, getting back to Michael Hastings, this is quite clear to me that, I mean, even the CIA even admitted that they can then use this ability to hack cars as a way to covertly assassinate people. And I think Michael Hastings was covertly assassinated. I think actually the guy is an absolute hero of journalism. He did a really good book as well called The Operators, which is all about how the military really just had a total disdain for the population, the ordinary members of the public, and the politicians that we elect, and they just get on and do what the hell they want anyway, and they have no respect at all for the people who are paying their wages. They have no respect for the country, countrymen and women of the countries which they're supposed to be serving. And they're just basically like overgrown teenagers playing with massive weapons, getting a kind of kick out of being the most macho on the scene. So this book, The Operators, is really, you know, people haven't come across that. Do ever read a bit Michael Hastings' book, because I think it's really for his journalism and for writing that book and exposing I think it was McChrystal that had to resign as a result. The guy who was in charge of the US troops in Afghanistan had to resign as a result of one of Michael Hastings' reports. This is the kind of military that we really need to weed out, not just in the United States, but obviously in the UK too. You know, we've got our own people in our military. We used to call, I don't know if you've heard the term before, the green slime, George.
The green slime
were an R. These are the guys in military intelligence that go in and they basically pretend to be the other side. So they'll be involved in all sorts of like counter gang operations where they'll go in and set up groups which are supposed to be fighting them, you know, so they are trying to basically play both sides of the chessboard, and so they'll be killing their own people in order to gain some kind of propaganda advantage in one way or another, maybe to get more money to fight the war, to actually get the war going in a more trenchant fashion, so that they can commit more troops to a particular war zone. The green slime I mean, we have one guy, particularly Brigadier Gordon Kerr in Northern Ireland, who was doing this the whole time, something called the Force Research Unit. And I think in many ways, Northern Ireland was a kind of model for the sorts of sectarian conflicts we're seeing in the Middle East, particularly in the Middle East, you know, the sort of Catholic-Protestant divide, which wasn't really a Catholic-Protestant, it was a unionist-nationalist or loyalist Republican divide, to be more accurate, a loyalist Republican divide, which wasn't religious, it was cultural, and it was part of the two different cultures. That was exactly what we've seen throughout the Middle East, particularly with the sort of split between the Shia and the Sunnis. You know, these, again, a cultural divide, which is characterized as some sort of religious divide, the idea being to sort of win a propaganda victory and tell everyone, well, this religion is complete rubbish, obviously these people are crazy, they're just killing each other. The fact of the matter is, you know, Northern Ireland was never really about religion. It was about the two cultures, the Republican culture, which is like unity with Southern Ireland, and the Unionist culture, which was very much Masonic, Orange Order, and very, very loyal to the British Crown in a fanatical, fundamentalist fashion. Yeah. So these weren't ordinary religious factions. They're crazy religious factions, fake religions, a bit like ISIS, or like the Puritans in the English Civil War, who were completely like fanatical, crazed, swivel-eyed Protestants, you know, who were just completely off, out of control. So that's what I think we're dealing with now, is the sort of thing that was trained for in Northern Ireland first, George. We're seeing that happen all over the Middle East now with the factional infighting, which has been deliberately created.
Right. Roger Stone got T-boned here the other day down in Florida. And then the truck driver that hit him ran off with, and it was a hit and run. So,
sorry, who did?
Roger Stone got T-boned down in Florida, and got on his car on the driver's side. A truck hit him right on the side of his car when he was driving in Florida a few days ago, about a week ago.
Well, I haven't heard about that.
Yeah, and so they're out there working. You know, he got polonium poisoned, we think, you know, several months ago. So, and now we got T-boned by some truck driver that ran off, you know, hit and run. So, what you said, you know, about Hastings.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, we were on to Hastings from the beginning, but we couldn't prove it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, now with the confirmation.
That's right, yeah. I think the thing is there is always the evidence. I mean, the evidence in the Hastings right from the start was Mercedes refused to answer any questions. Okay, that's number one. That is evidence.
Right.
If the Mercedes don't cooperate with you, you have to say, what the hell are they doing? Why aren't they cooperating? You've got to cooperate. There's someone's just died in one of your cars. Why aren't you cooperating, number one? Number two is your red light, the brake light on his car, rammed on. What's going on there? Number three, him saying to his girlfriend, something funny going on with my car, please can I borrow yours? And she said, unfortunately, no, because my car's going in for a service tomorrow. Anyway, so I'm going to need it, you know, to take it there and back, so you can't borrow my car. There are other circumstantial things, like, you know, in that nobody is in their right mind is going to be doing 70, 80 miles an hour. Another piece of evidence before anything from the CIA leaks was also that the engine appeared to explode before the car actually hit the tree. So, you know, there were quite a lot of indications that this was an assassination of a journalist, a murder of a journalist, you know, right at the very beginning.
Right. It was highly suspicious from the very, very beginning. But this Roger Stone thing just, you know, about a week ago, it shook him up. He didn't go to the hospital, and he went ahead and carried on his reporting and, you know, on the radio that he has and everything. But, you know, it's getting...
Well, we had the Gary Webb, the case of Gary Webb as well, didn't we, of course, a few years ago, reporting on the Iran-Contra.
Right, right. Gary Webb had been fired by the San Jose Mercury, and he had broken the drug dealing in South L.A., and they didn't want to hear it. They you know, the CIA evidently started crack down there or something, crack, you know, epidemic.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you've got an arrogant elite who are criminals, effectively an organized crime, running the show.
Exactly.
And I suppose what you could say is we should be a bit worried in a way that these guys, as it looks like a lot of their plans are hitting brick walls in Syria, Ukraine, and elsewhere, that we should place the empire on suicide watch. You know, because these people are getting, you know, to the point where they may do something really crazy because they're starting to be found out. They're starting to show out. And we all know that that's what these sort of people do. You know, once it looks as if the spotlight's starting to turn on them, rather than them being able to just run things. So everything they do starts to not work because so many people know what they're up to. Then there's a really good article, actually, along those lines. Placed the empire on suicide watch.
Really?
On the Saker website.
My gosh.
I don't know if you know the Saker. He's this guy that used to work as a military advisor for the United Nations. And I interviewed him over Christmas time. I was just really impressed with his analysis of the global affairs. One of the things, for example, he's done for me, which is to clarify for me, is really to affirm what I suppose I kind of assumed anyway, which is that you've got 80% of the effort of the military now going into psychological warfare as part of, fighting other countries, trying to get their way, warfare now, 80% of it is psychological. So that's massive amounts of resources put into the mainstream media, mainly.
Right.
Lies, manipulation of those sorts. And then 15% is going into economic warfare, and that leaves only 5% for real fighting. So, you know, for actual guns and weapons and things like that, because they're realizing that they're starting to come up against these various brick walls, which they can't fight. And if they do fight the little guys, then the people at home have got no confidence in them. So they have to use psychological tactics instead. And this is where we're going with Goebbels, you know, the Goebbels world, because he was one of the main operators in Nazi Germany. Joseph Goebbels. I mean, there are others like Goering who weren't, you know, actually were pretty disgusted with what Hitler was doing, particularly with the extermination of the Jews. He wasn't in favour of that. In fact, he kept some very close Jewish friends and looked after them, you know. But Goebbels was obsessed with this thing about destroying Jews, as was, of course, Himmler, Eichmann, and people like that, you know. So there were various factions in Nazi Germany, and I think in a way, you know, I find it fascinating to study Nazi Germany. I still do read stuff on it, you know, because in a way, what was happening there was in the 1930s, late 30s and 40s, what we saw was our opposition, George. You know, this is basically the bad people of this world who decided that they're going to steal a march on everyone else by being a bunch of crooks and criminals. But what they did is they showed out in a massive way, like I think they'd never done before. And they've certainly ever since been trying to do everything they can, possibly hidden. But you could see them very, very clearly. It was almost like a beast rising above the surface of the sea. Hey, let's get a good look at this thing before it disappears again. You know, so I'm not studying Nazi Germany from a mawkish point of view, but because I think it tells us so much about what's going on today.
Right. After that assassination, the last one against Hitler, Goebbels took over command. They were trying to take over his opposition command of Berlin, but Goebbels stopped the revolution from happening right after Hitler was injured and actually put down the revolution that was the military coup that was underway, from my readings. So Goebbels did save...
No, you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah, he did. And there were key...
Yeah,
there were key elements and people that he was still talking to. He was still talking to Hitler, see. They didn't cut off that communication to him. And that sort of saved Hitler's regime temporarily, you know. But,
Well, I mean, in the end, it was inevitable, and everybody knew that. But
yes,
there were a few people that fought to the end, weren't there? You know, and you're right. Goebbels was a key guy at the time. And the propaganda ministry was, you know, very, very important in, first of all, in demonizing the Jews. You know, this is one thing which is, you know, if you look at it, you couldn't make it up, where certain Jews who were very rich and powerful were kind of considered to be not Jews, and all the rest were rounded up in concentration camps and put in forced labor and starved, etc., etc.
Right.
But mainly it's because there are different sorts of Jews, just as there are different sorts of Christians. And ones who were very steeped in the Old Testament rabbinic tradition, those were the ones that Goebbels wanted dead. You know, he wanted it, that part of the main operation of what Nazi Germany was about, that a lot of people miss this, was really just to exterminate in Europe any kind of vestige of an understanding of Old Testament law, really, the way that you know, sort of Old Testament morality. That's what the Jewish people had across Europe, and that's what the Nazis wanted to scrub out, because the Nazi Empire really was a pagan empire, with Hitler as God and with Himmler as his prophet, you know, so he's kind of high priest guy, in charge of the SS. So that was where you've got this kind of religious element. Really, it was a religion. Nazism was a sort of twisted religion. But look, let's get back to some of the stuff that's been going on this week, because there's been so much happening. We've got these two massive attacks in Syria, and I'm starting to look upon this as a kind of there's been a Russian victory, really, in a way, in Aleppo just before Christmas. There's now the clearing out of Mosul, for example. ISIS seems to be really on the back foot in Syria. But what is happening is we're getting horrendous bomb attacks by, you know, big inverted commas, by ISIS. You had on the Wednesday, I think it was, double bombings in Damascus, with 30 or so people killed at the courthouse, and a restaurant, 20 plus people killed in a restaurant. Now, this is supposed to be suicide bombings, George, and you know what? Nobody needs to be a suicide bomber in a restaurant. If you're going to kill somebody in a restaurant, you don't need to run in and blow yourself up. You just leave a bag and walk out, right. And then you press the button and the bomb goes off. There's absolutely no need for any kind of suicide bombing, either in a courthouse or in a restaurant. This whole thing stinks to me, stinks to high heaven. If it's a hard target, if it's a military target, perhaps someone will be, you know, you might decide you want a suicide bombing, but you don't need to do that in a restaurant. You know, absolutely insane, and the press never questioned this. And of course, there was back in the 11th of March, there were 46 Iraqis killed in a cemetery. Again, supposedly a suicide bombing in a cemetery. So you don't need a suicide bombing, a bomber, in a cemetery. You just leave a bomb and walk away and blow it up. That's what you would do if you were a real terrorist. But I don't believe these people are real terrorists, George. Also, of course, the day after there was a mosque bombing, the US Air Force apparently saying that they didn't bomb the mosque. They bombed the religious school next door. But actually, the pictures on the ground show that the bomb did go through the religious school, destroyed the roof, and went into the mosque next door. And I'm not sure how many people were killed. I think it's about 35 were killed in a mosque. Now, just a minute. If, for example, the Iranian Air Force were to come and bomb a church in Albuquerque, put a bomb through the window and blow everybody up inside, what do you think would be the Western press's reaction to that?
Well, I don't know. What would you say?
Well, they go nuts. They go nuts. You can't do this. What are they doing? They're bombing funerals. They're bombing marriages. Yeah. They're bombing wedding ceremonies. They're bombing religious services. This is quite a deliberate tactic, I think, in order to destroy, attempt to, first of all, to commit horrific war crimes, and secondly, to attack the morale of the people.
Right.
And they're thinking, well, if these people will kill us in the mosque, in the church, in the synagogue, you know, and our places of worship, if they'll just blow us up, then we can't go to mosque. We're sitting there praying to our God, and then they're blowing us to pieces while we're doing that. This really is, I don't think there was even the Nazis deliberately targeting, you know, their V1 bombs or V2 bombs or, you know, 100 bomber bombing raids, deliberately targeting cathedrals, you know, during the Second World War.
Right.
But that's what's happening now, George. You know, the religious services are basically now a place where people are fearing for their lives in Syria. Am I going to be blown to bits?
Well, it has the characteristics of Manchurian Candidate's programmed people, then, see? But, you know, some of those fanatical Muslims will do that anyway.
Some of these Muslims will do that, I'm quite sure. And, you know, there are probably Christians and Jews that would do the same, die for their faith or whatever. But the point being here is, I think what's happening is individuals have got bombs on them. Maybe they don't even know that it's a bomb on them. So it could be a backpack they've been told to go in somewhere.
Yeah, it could be set up. That's true. That could be going on.